I could name five sectors. One was obviously hospitality sector, people not traveling. The other was tourism. Tourism contributes 7% of GDP in India. That was one of the major sectors. India also relies on very high, let's say, internal migration. So because you had labor markets disrupted with lockdowns, so 21 days, two, 3 months of lockdown, a first wave, then another waves of lockdowns. So we had a very low productivity-led construction sector. So construction sector was affected heavily, and you could see lines of people going back to their rural hinterlands for agriculture work. Then there was this aviation sector. So because there was no travel, so all the flights were cancelled. So that was really hard. And I think the last sector which was affected was, I can say, public transport. Because you have no work, most work from home was happening. So one of the sectors which really was affected, because public transport, railways in India, let's say public utilities like metros. So like in the world, it's slowly emerging back since last 2 years. So people have some semblance. So hospitality is back to pre-pandemic level. Aviation is back. We do see a lot of construction happening. So infrastructure projects, dedicated, let's say, freight corridor in India, it's coming back.
Mr. Gaglani, today the South Asian country is struggling with a widening trade deficit, dwindling currency, soaring inflation and other issues. So could you tell us what has gone wrong?
Like across the world, because it was a 2 years of pandemic, so we had a lot of, let's say, supply side disruptions. So I see, let's say, the dwindling rupee, the trade deficits and all these things in two major categories. First is the international factor. So we had, let's say, 2 years of supply side shocks. You had, let's say, semiconductors and chips were not working. So automobile sector, which was also hit hardest. So that was one of the, all electronics were hit hard. Second, we all know the unfortunate Russian-Ukraine conflict that has totally disrupted the, let's say, the energy, oil prices and crude prices. And India imports 85% of its, let's say, crude resources from the world. So that's one of the major factors which has done this. And also you can see, because there was this liquidity trap, which, let's say, last financial conditions were worsening, we could see some sort of Fed in the US taking back and the liquidity, which was excess liquidity, which was provided during the pandemic, the excess kind of stimulus was taken back. That created, because India relies heavily on FDI inflows, that would, so we saw a lot, let's say, a periodic 2 to 3 years of FDI on FPI inflows going back. The outflows were happening. And let's say these were the international factors. These were the larger systematic factors which has affected countries around the world.
Mr. Gaglani, India's finance minister Nirmala Sitharaman attributes the fall of the rupee to external factors like the Russia-Ukraine war, rising crude oil prices and worsening global financial conditions. So what's your take on this?
Mehdi, I do concur largely with Minister Sitharaman, because we are very heavy, let's say, oil and gas dependent country. Our imports are 85%. We are dependent on crude prices and everything. So the actual trade deficit got worsened. So I have this one fact. So if you look at quarter two of 2021, or let's say the spending on oil was $25 billion. But if you see the quarter two of this year, it has gone up to $45 billion. So that kind of trade deficit is directly linked with this change in, let's say, the oil prices, which is almost like $100 right now. Another reason, which I also mentioned in my last intervention, was this. Because a lot of, let's say, global financial recession at US, we might see, because India relies heavily on, let's say, the software exports. So if you look at the trade deficit, or let's say the full balance of payments basket in India, we have surplus in, let's say, invisibles. We export, let's say, software, pharma, which helps us. And we also import this kind of oil and gold and other minerals and all from. So in that sense, because the market of oil has disrupted, this has changed our, let's say, balance of payments. And also, because there's this global recession, as you see in US, we might see some sort of cuts in our exports as well. So in that way, I do concur that largely our trade deficit and, let's say, depreciation of rupee is due to external factors.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Guglani, public policy researcher from New Delhi, for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Javier Shergill, a Congress Party spokesman and Supreme Court lawyer, questions the Modi government's economic policy at a time when India's trade deficit has jumped with increasing imports and decreasing exports, urging the government to act to revive business. A member of India's parliament, Jawahar Sirkar, points to India's dependence on China by noting that imports have reached almost $100 billion, while exports remain less than a quarter of it. Pargat Singh, a sportsperson turned politician, says galloping inflation and rising fuel prices are making life miserable for the ordinary people in India, sharing pictures of a protest against fuel prices.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
For the Muslims in Kashmir, Muharram commemorations have always been central to their faith. People have offered blood, sweat and tears to keep the tradition of mourning for the martyrs of Karbala alive. From the first Islamic missionaries that came to Kashmir from Iran more than four centuries ago till today, the tradition of Azadari in the Himalayan region has tremendously evolved and gained popularity, playing a pivotal role in preserving the distinct identity of Kashmiri Shias.
According to historians, Azadari in Muharram was popularized in Kashmir by Sayyid Ali Hamadani, the Sufi luminary who came to Kashmir from Iran in the 14th century. A staunch lover of Ahlul Bayt, he is believed to have brought many symbols of heritage from Karbala. The popularity of Persian Noahs in Kashmir is largely attributed to him. Another important figure is Sayyid Shamsuddin Araghi, who also came from Iran. During his time, the practice of Muharram commemorations became widespread in Kashmir. Until then, people would do Azadari inside bungalows owned by Shia aristocrats. He built the first Husseiniyah in Srinagar that in later centuries emerged as a symbol of Shia resilience.
Imam Hussein's personality cannot be defined. We have tried for the last 1400 years to carry forward his teachings and his values. And with passing time, we have seen more and more people are joining the caravan of Hussein. Imam Hussein is an epitome of greatness. And his sacrifice for Islamic teachings and values teaches the way forward. The first step is unity among Muslims.
During the Chalk rule in the 16th century, Kashmiri elegies gained unprecedented prominence and Azadari expanded far and wide. However, after the fall of Shia Chalks, the dark period started for Kashmiri Shias during the rule of Mughals and Afghans, when Muharram gatherings went underground. Shias were attacked and looted more than a dozen times, and the historic Husseiniyah at Zadibal Srinagar was also razed to the ground many times. During the Dogra rule in the 19th century, the first Muharram procession was taken out during the daytime in Kashmir. In 1989, the procession was banned by the government, citing a law and order problem, even though the processions are totally peaceful.
The trials and tribulations continue for Shia Muslims in Indian-controlled Kashmir. For the past 32 years, traditional Muharram processions in Srinagar, the summer capital of the region, remain banned. Heavy restrictions are imposed every year on Muharram 8 and 10 in the city centre amid large deployment of troops. Like every year, this year too, mourners defied the government crackdown to take out peaceful processions. And like every year, security personnel resorted to force to disperse the processions and manhandle the mourners.
This year, two Muharram processions in the summer capital of Kashmir were broken up by security forces using unwarranted force. Young mourners were brutally beaten and manhandled. The government ban on traditional Muharram 8 and 10 processions remains in place since 1989, when the armed rebellion against Indian rule in the contested Himalayan region gained momentum.
All our Indian people enjoy religious freedom, but when it comes to Kashmir, they adopt double standards. Peaceful mourners here are thrashed and arrested for raising Labaik Ya Hussain slogans.
Each year, curfew-like restrictions are imposed in parts of the city. Iron barricades and spools of concertina wires are put up at every entry point. However, mourners defy the crackdown each year and take out peaceful mourning processions in the city. Each time, they are intercepted by large contingent of police and paramilitary forces who resort to baton charge and arrest the mourners.
The government is hurting the religious sentiments of people here. We condemn it in the strongest term. Kashmiri's people have made it very clear that they will not accept the ban on procession. Even if they are beaten and arrested, they will raise the flag of Imam Hussein.
Muslims in Kashmir have been demanding revocation of the draconian ban, which they see as a blatant breach of their religious freedom and denial of fundamental human rights. They point to double standards of the government, which provides patronage and support for the annual Amarnath Yatra of Hindus, but denies the same right to Kashmiri Shias. There has been a long-running legal battle against the ban led by Kashmiri-based Shia organizations, but nothing has come out of it.
Now, to talk on this, we are joined by Mr. Sayyid Isar Mehdi. He's a religious scholar at South Asian University in New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Mehdi. Now, Kashmir has a rich socio-cultural history, and the tradition of Muharram commemorations date back many centuries. Can you briefly tell us how this tradition evolved in the region over the past years?
This is a very interesting question. Muharram is the month in which the beloved grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, Imam Hussain al-Islam, was martyred, along with his family and friends, in the desert of Karbala, by the tyrant called Yazid. Every year, around this time, massive processions take place across the world and also in Kashmir to pay rich tribute to martyr of Karbala. But in Kashmir, what happens that both the communities, the majority community and also the minority community, they come together and commemorate these processions. In Kashmir, it started in 1527 when Sultan Muhammad Shah was the ruler. And during that time, Shia Muslims, along with the Sunni Muslims, used to commemorate these processions together. And there were two major processions that were taken out from Kashmir. One from Nimash Bal to Imam Bara Zadibal, and the other from Alamgiri Bazar to Kushal Sar. Both these processions were basically taken out by Shias and Sunnis together. And also in 1977, when Sheikh Abdullah was the chief minister, he was also, because of his request, there was a joint procession taken out by both the communities from Abi Guzar to Zadibab, which is basically in Imam Bara. But what happened in 90s, in late 90s, what happened, the wave of militancy took over Kashmir. And at that time, the governor of the JNK imposed ban on the procession as a sweeping measure to deal with the political unrest. But after that, nothing happened. The ban was not lifted. And it still remains in the state.
Mr. Mehdi, what elements of Muharram commemorations are unique to Kashmir? And also, can you tell us a bit about Kashmiri Marsiyas, which are integral to these commemorations?
Marsiyas are very unique in Kashmir, and they have served a purpose of basically safeguarding Shia identity in Kashmir. Shia identity and Marsiya are they are basically hand and glove. What they have done, what Marsiya has done basically, they have basically survived Shia identity. Marsiya is a unique feature to Kashmiri Shia identity, and because of the Marsiya, Karbala and the martyrdom of Imam Hussein has survived and has lived from generation to generation. Marsiya has basically four important parts. The first part is that's called Hamd. In Hamd, what you do, you praise Allah. Second part is basically Naat. What you do, you praise Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And then there's third part that's called Madah. In Madah, what you do, you praise Imam Ali al-Islam. You glorify him. And then there's last part where you should reveal the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. You show that how Imam Hussein Islam gave his blood to tell the world that to never follow the dictates of an oppressor. You basically reveal that how Imam Hussein Islam offered a peerless sacrifice in Karbala only to uphold human values, and eventually gave his head, not hand, to set an example for the world that give away everything but never buckle before a tyrant.
Mr. Mehdi, in many parts of the Muslim-majority region, we have seen Shias and Sunnis together taking part in Muharram processions and events. Now, could you say Azadari is a thread that binds the two communities together?
Obviously. If we look at the event of Karbala itself, you will see that this whole episode of Karbala, there are voices of unity. Karbala has that glue within it. Even, in fact, in Kashmir, you will see, as I said earlier, that Kashmiris use it to take processions together. Both majority and minority community use it to perform, use it to, you know, basically take out these processions together. As I said, in 1527, when Sultan Muhammad Shah was the ruler, Shia Muslims, who are the minority, used to take the procession with the Sunni majority together. In fact, there were two processions, as I said, from Nemechbal to Imam Barazadipal, and the other from Alamgiri Bazar to Kushalsar. Both were taken by Shia and Sunni communities together.
Thank you, Mr. Mehdi, for being on the program. He's a religious scholar at South Asian University in New Delhi. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Saqib Mughlu, a Kashmiri journalist, says while the world grapples with sectarianism and extremism, Kashmiris continue to set examples of Shia-Sunni brotherhood, sharing a picture of Sunnis providing beverages and food items to Shia mourners. Kargil-based political activist Sajjad Kargili, pointing to double standards on religious freedom, notes that while Muharram processions are allowed across India, in Kashmir they are banned by the government.
And that was our episode about the economic crisis facing India and the traditional Muharram commemorations in Kashmir. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
Mm-hmm.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Kalav Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. There are many blessings and benefits in paying visit to the holy tombs of the infallibles. The late Ayatollah Behjat used to visit the tomb of Lady Fatimah al-Masuma in the city of Qom for 7 years every day. Also, the late Imam Khomeini used to visit the tomb of Imam Ali alayhi salam for 15 years when he was exiled in Najaf. Also, the late Haj Agha Hussain Qommi used to visit the tomb of Lady Fatimah al-Masuma in the city of Qom every day. The holy tombs of Ahlul Bayt have many blessings for their visitors. As you might know, the holy grave of Hazrat Fatima is unknown. Thus, we must benefit from the blessings of the tomb of Lady Masuma in Qom. Allah made the grave of Hazrat Masuma hidden. However, He sent His blessings upon the grave of Lady Masuma so that the people can benefit from her blessings. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Kalav Islam page, which was the English translation of a short Persian speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Kalav Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
While Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman were key lawyers for former U.S. President Donald Trump and his campaign, respectively, and Jeffrey Clark was a senior Justice Department official, the trio played big roles in a brazen multi-front drive not to certify some of Joe Biden's electors, but bogus ones for Donald Trump. We have prepared for you an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled, Lawyers Feel Heat as Legal Net Tightens on Trump Plot to Overturn Election. Former prosecutors say an accelerating Justice Department investigation into a fake electoral scheme to help Donald Trump overturn the 2020 election, plus exclusive testimony from January 6 hearings, have created intense legal heat for the lawyers Jeffrey Clark, Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman, who were key players in the abortive effort. While Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman were key lawyers for Donald Trump and his campaign, respectively, and Jeffrey Clark was a senior Justice Department official, the trio played big roles in a brazen multi-front drive not to certify some of Biden electors but bogus ones for Donald Trump. That could fuel charges against Trump, who they collaborated with for obstruction of an official proceeding of Congress or defrauding the United States. Legal experts say recent Justice Department actions, including seizing electronic devices of John Eastman and Jeffrey Clark, coupled with some evidence at committee hearings, are increasingly likely to spur charges against the three lawyers related to the drive to replace electors Biden won in seven states with fake electors for Donald Trump. The Justice Department's expanding criminal inquiry became palpable on 22nd of June when FBI agents raided Jeffrey Clark's home and separately seized John Eastman's cell phone, as grand jury subpoenas involving the scheme were served up on top Republican figures and Trump allies in Georgia and Arizona. In another stark sign of the legal jeopardy Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman face, recent House committee hearings into the attack on the Capitol offered evidence that both lawyers sought pardons from Donald Trump, presumably tied to plotting strategies to block Biden's certification by Congress on 6th of January 2021, and fiery speeches they gave along with Trump at a rally on their lips before a mob of Trump allies and supporters attacked the Capitol. The legal threats facing Jeffrey Clark were underscored at a 23rd of June panel hearing by scathing testimony from former top justice officials about Donald Trump's plotting with Jeffrey Clark to elevate him to acting attorney general to push the fake electoral scheme by falsely claiming in a proposed letter to Georgia officials that the Department of Justice had significant concern about election fraud there and in other states. The former acting Deputy Attorney General, Richard Donohue, was scolding as he detailed Trump's efforts to replace the acting Attorney General, Jeffrey Rosen, with Jeffrey Clark in late December 2020, and to pressure state legislatures to reject Joe Biden electors by promoting baseless charges of widespread election fraud. Richard Donohue recounted how he warned Donald Trump at a bizarre 3rd of January White House meeting that was attended by Jeffrey Rosen, Donald Trump counsel Pat Cipollone, and other top lawyers, that elevating Clark to be acting attorney general would spark mass resignations, and Clark would be left leading a graveyard at the Justice Department. Pat Cipollone, who was recently subpoenaed by the House panel, also threatened to resign if Jeffrey Clark replaced Jeffrey Rosen. Further, according to shocking testimony on 28th of June by Cassidy Hutchinson, a top aide to the former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, Cipollone warned her early on 6th of January of potential criminal liability for Trump and others if Donald Trump went to the Capitol as he had discussed doing, and asked Hutchinson to please make sure we don't go up to the Capitol. All of it adds to potentially grave consequences for the three lawyers. Michael Zeldin, a former Department of Justice prosecutor, said the strong evidence presented about the fake electoral scheme at a recent House committee hearing, including testimony by senior Justice Department officials, laid the foundation for charging Trump's legal advisers, John Eastman and Rudy Giuliani, and possibly Jeffrey Clark, with multiple state and federal crimes, including obstruction of an official congressional proceeding, conspiracy to defraud the United States, false statements in connection with the fake electoral scheme, and election fraud. Michael Zeldin added, the cumulative evidence presented over the course of the hearings paint a picture of a president who was told explicitly by multiple people that he'd lost the election, and that once he exhausted his judicial remedies, losing nearly 60 cases, his continuing pressure campaign to prevent the orderly transfer of power was illegal. Yet Trump and his attorneys persisted. Other former prosecutors stressed that the FBI raids to obtain Jeffrey Clark and John Eastman's phones indicate the investigations of the two lawyers have escalated. Barbara McQuaid, a former U.S. attorney for Eastern Michigan, told The Guardian, "Search warrants of Jeffrey Clark and John Eastman's phones means that a judge found probable cause to believe that evidence of a crime would be found on each of those devices." John Eastman's exposure to criminal charges has been palpable and growing for months. In March, a federal judge, David Carter, in a crucial court ruling involving Donald Trump's legal adviser, John Eastman, stated that Trump, more likely than not, broke the law in his weeks-long drive to stop Joe Biden from taking office. In a civil case which resulted in an order for John Eastman to release more than 100 emails he had withheld from the House panel, Judge David Carter wrote, "Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history." Other revelations damaging to Donald Trump and John Eastman emerged at a mid-June House panel hearing with Greg Jacob, the former counsel to former Vice President Mike Pence, providing detailed testimony about how Eastman and Trump launched a high-pressure effort to persuade Mike Pence to unlawfully block Joe Biden's certification by Congress on 6th of January 2021. The John Eastman pressure included the scheme to substitute pro-Trump fake electors from states that Biden won for electors rightfully pledged to Biden. Greg Jacob testified that Eastman acknowledged to him that he knew his push to get Mike Pence on 6th of January to reject Biden's winning Electoral College count would violate the Electoral Count Act, and that Donald Trump, too, was informed it would be illegal for Mike Pence to block Joe Biden's certification. In mid-December of 2020, at least 59 Republicans from states that Trump had lost falsely asserted and signed legal documents that they were duly chosen electors for Trump in the Electoral College. Barbara McQuaid, a former U.S. attorney for Eastern Michigan, said former prosecutors say potential charges against Trump and his top lawyers have increased in part due to the powerful details that former Department of Justice leaders testified about on 23rd of June, involving how Trump pushed to weaponize the Justice Department to facilitate the fake electoral scheme. Barbara McQuaid noted that the Deputy Attorney General, Lisa Monaco, months ago confirmed Department of Justice had received evidence from state attorney generals about alternate slates of electors and was investigating. It appears the Department of Justice is now issuing subpoenas regarding this episode. One could imagine each link leading to the next and possibly all the way to Donald Trump. On top of Trump's involvement in the fake electors ploy, former Deputy Attorney General Donald Eyre, who served in the George H.W. Bush administration, told The Guardian that overall, the evidence is increasingly showing Trump's culpability. Donald Trump had extensive involvement in long conversations where he was personally working intently to overturn the election. Donald Eyre's point was bolstered by Cassidy Hutchinson's eye-popping testimony about Trump's knowledge of and indifference to the large cache of dangerous weapons that were being carried by his supporters to the Capitol. Paul Pelletier, a former acting chief of Department of Justice Fraud Section, said that for prosecutors, the powerful testimony of Cassidy Hutchinson might be the final nail in the legal jeopardy coffin of Trump's coterie of lawyers and enablers. He added, Hutchinson's testimony has lifted the curtain on the false narrative that the violent Capitol confrontation was spontaneous. The Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse sees a need for coordination of criminal investigations between the Department of Justice and others into the multiple efforts by Trump and key allies to block Joe Biden's win in Georgia, including Trump's call to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, which is under scrutiny by the Fulton County District Attorney and a special grand jury. Sheldon Whitehouse told The Guardian, "Phony electors, the Jeffrey Clark memo and Trump's phone calls all converge on Georgia." He added, "I hope and expect that the investigations are coordinated. The raid on Jeffrey Clark shows how serious this is, and false electors could make great witnesses."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful, assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program, Islamic Upbringing. This is a program wherein we provide you with necessary information to be able to provide necessary grounds for your children to flourish and to attain perfection, which is the ultimate goal of Islam. Well, today in our studio, we have with us Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad is a researcher in the Hafza Ilmi of Qom, who will be providing us answers on the basis of Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you so much, Jazakallah.
Well, we are talking about the upbringing of teenagers. And Brother Miqdad, do you know teenagers these days are big football fans? Is that okay?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'd like to say that you don't really have a choice in today's world. To be a football fan or not is a very natural part of a teenage life, or generally, in most teenagers' case. But it's an important topic to discuss nonetheless. I think we can explore a few important points regarding this. And inshallah, it can be of use for parents to help their children, help their teenagers in this regard.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll mention a couple of points, and inshallah, hopefully this will be useful. So first and foremost, the football attitude and the football craze out there is something new. It wasn't there a long time ago. And one of the things that it builds on is identity.
Okay.
Children look for identities. And one of the things that gives them an identity in today's world is football. And so you could say perhaps that it is one of the reasons could be our failure in providing youth and teenagers with identity.
Okay.
Nowadays you ask teenagers about their identity, they'll tell you, I'm this football clan, this football club's fan. I don't mention a particular football team, not to
kind promote of them.
Promote them or even yeah. hurt someone's feelings, because they might not support
okay.
them. But you would kind of associate yourself and make an identity based on that. So, and this is because we haven't provided an alternative identity. So this is one point that we need to, as a food for thought, for people to think about it. Like, can we create a strong identity, a Muslim identity, an identity that will bring people together, basically,
mm-hmm.
can substitute football today. That's the first point.
Okay.
The second point, watching football in itself, how much time wasting you could say it is, or how in some cases it doesn't really bring anything into you, but something that is very common, very natural for people to do. What you want to promote a bit more is the playing of football.
Okay.
There's a difference between supporting and watching football and playing. So when it comes to playing football, obviously it's a very, in many cases, a very dangerous game. It's a very, it's a game that harms your body a lot.
Okay.
But nonetheless, it's a sport. And as an exercise, as a sport, and even as a social exercise, I recommend youth to get involved.
Okay.
Because as teenagers, it's very important that we are playing sports. Obviously, there are better sports than football. Sports out there that take martial arts, for example, gymnastics, for example. These other sports that are out there, you could say that they're much better in fulfilling this need that we have to strengthen our body.
Okay.
To feel happy within ourselves through physical activity. But nonetheless, football is one of them. So we should be encouraging youth to take part in sports and football. And therefore, if teenagers are involved in football, then encourage them to play more than watch. If they're just watching for the sake of watching, not even playing, mm-hmm. I would say push them towards playing. That's very important, because they should have this physical activity with them.
All right. So the first point you said here, that you recommended some of the sports, and then you said you recommend playing rather than watching. I'll talk more on you on that note after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about if teenager is a football fan, is that okay? You suggest or you recommend parents that they should get their teenagers involved in the sports rather than watching it.
That's correct. So another thing that we need to keep in mind is that we should keep football supporting on the pitch. So keep it on the pitch only. One of the things you want to avoid teenagers doing is to go into the personal lives of football players.
Okay.
And take them as role models outside of football. This is very important. See, if these football players are role models when it comes to football, to some extent this is okay.
This is okay.
Right? Because, yes, they play amazing football and we enjoy the way they play and we can learn from how they play. And
okay.
If you're watching to learn how these people play, then that's good. But you want to encourage your teenagers to keep it at that. Not go further. Because these individuals, in most cases, they're not the right role models in what they do in their personal lives.
In their personal lives.
So how they behave outside of the pitch, outside the pitch, basically.
Yeah.
In terms of what kind of personal life they have, what other things they do in their free time, what behavior they have, what attitude they have towards life and towards different things. Following them on Instagram, for example, where they put personal photos of themselves, of their cars, of their families, etc.
And the crazy other things personal that they do, information.
That's you want to kind of avoid, basically.
Okay.
So you want to teach your teenager that I'm happy for you to follow a particular team, follow a particular player, but keep it on the pitch.
Okay.
Let's talk football just for football, not beyond that. This is important.
Okay.
At times, football is used for other than football in the sense of political means and political messages or social messages. So, for example, you had support for black community, so
true.
Anti-racism, for example,
true,
or support for the Palestinian cause. That I would say to some extent it's okay if you're using football for a greater purpose.
Yeah,
and you're teaching your child that greater purpose is very important. That thing that you stand for, justice. Human rights in the terminology of Islamic beliefs.
Yeah.
Or other very important causes, whether it's the supporting the oppressed, etc. If sports is used for that context, then in some stages, you could say that this could be a good thing. But not the personal lives and not the trash that happens outside of the pitch in terms of those things.
And even there are many football players who avoided to go playing into the countries where they found a big list of human rights of violations. So that was also a good thing, like maybe our teenagers can actually be impacted with. So I'll be talking to you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Blessed and happy is the one who accepts Islam. His sustenance is enough and his body is strong."
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Oh, we are talking if our teenagers are football fans. Is that okay or not? Brother, you discussed a very beautiful point up to where it's okay. Like, if your teenagers are following a particular football player as a fan, just looking at their game, it's okay. But if they're going beyond, just peeping into their personal lives, they're following them on the social media platforms, that way it's a little like we should avoid our teenagers. What else do you recommend parents to do?
Another thing that we need to be careful of is that this supporting a football team shouldn't go to the extreme where we abide by the lack of etiquette, the lack of akhlaq when it comes to dealing with others.
Okay.
So football is, and supporting a particular football camp comes with hating another club.
Okay.
This part of the game, right? When you're supporting one club, that means you don't
support
another.
Your rival at that time.
Exactly. And that should never lead us to cross boundaries of the Sharia and of general morality and akhlaq. This is very important. Unfortunately, many clubs, many fans of clubs are known for being hooligans and being individuals that kind of would break the law, would cause damage to public properties, would even be engaged in fights and using foul language, using bad language, using violence in the name of football.
Okay.
There's something you need to teach our teenagers, that this is a red line, basically. We play football for the beauty of the game. And even though we might support another team, in every game there's a loser and a winner. Today we won, tomorrow we might lose, basically. And that doesn't mean that because of being on one team, it allows us and permits us and gives us a license to insult others, to humiliate others, to disrespect others.
And this, that's very important. That's very important.
Exactly. So this is something you teach, the etiquettes of being a football fan, basically. You can have a session with your teenagers. The etiquette of having a football fan is that you support a team and you can love them if you want, but we don't.
And also a very big concept that you mentioned over here, you teach them you can win and you can also lose, because we have some people in life who we meet who cannot accept losses or who don't know how to deal with them after they face a loss.
Lastly is when you talk about this morality, it's very important to, that on, when we're playing ourselves, when teenagers are playing as well, us as parents, we need to teach our children as well and our teenagers as well, that when you're playing, play the beautiful game, not the attitude shouldn't come with it as well. So when we're fouling others, for example, when we're cheating in the, on the pitch, we're using bad language and swear words, these things shouldn't come with it. So always teach your children that we're not against football. Football is a good game, but we want to see beautiful football. We don't want to see cheating. We don't want to see swearing. We don't want to see
fouling,
kind of fouling and these kind of things. These are very important aspects of football.
Okay, so you're basically teaching big ethics of life within the football itself. Thank you so much, brother, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us or any suggestions, comments for a program, please feel free to contact us on englishradio@irib.ir. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanallah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio,
Coming up is the news.